Welcome to Manny's, a people-powered, community-minded space at the corner of 16th and Valencia in the Mission. On a typical Friday night, Manny's is buzzing with music, political discussions, and a roster of speakers and performers. But these days, like most businesses, it is closed. Instead, Manny's is presenting a series of virtual conversations with local leaders and thinkers who are trying to make sense of this moment and how we will recover. KALW is airing a new conversation every Friday evening to keep you civically engaged while we are sheltered in place. Tonight, founder Manny Acutiel talks with author Michael Pollan about how coronavirus is shaping how we eat and why, right now, might not be a good time to try psychedelics.
Welcome everyone to Manny's. My name is Manny Acutiel, and today we are talking about eating, shopping, and gardening during the pandemic. So thank you all so much for joining. All right, Michael Pollan, first, drugs. Should we be tripping right now? And if yes, what should we do?
You know, you're not the first person to ask me this question. And it's really a complicated one. And I'm going to give you an equivocal answer. On one level, it seems like a perfect time to have journeys, because we can't have any literal journeys. And that you would think that psychedelics would be a way to get out of the box we all find ourselves in and extend our horizons of possibility. On the other side, you know, one of the key things to know about psychedelics has always been the importance of set and setting. Unlike most drugs, the results, what happens to you is very unpredictable and has a lot to do with your mindset and your physical setting. The physical setting might be okay, but you're probably indoors.
Probably don't want to be indoors.
Yeah, and then you have the mindset. And many of us are fearful and anxious for good reasons. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that wouldn't color the experience and might make it actually quite dark. So that's why I would be reluctant to do it under the circumstances. It'd be interesting to hear from people who've had good experiences. I totally get the superficial appeal of it, but I would not recommend it unless you're just really dealing with things in a wonderful way. And what if you need help? You know, what if you get into trouble? You can't really have somebody come over to help you out. And you certainly don't want to go to the emergency room. For some people, it's the perfect recipe for a bad experience.
Got it. Well, okay, let's get to your garden. Okay, first of all, Michael Pollan, tell me about your garden. Like, can you kind of visual, because I know you're very proud of it, but I can't come to your garden quite yet, but can you tell us about your garden? What's it like?
Sure. Well, you know, I live in Berkeley, so I don't have a lot of land. So most of my garden is at an enclosed front yard that we've got a wood fence with a couple gates facing the street. And behind that, we have a garden that's, I don't know, maybe 30 by 30 or so, 25 by 25. It's a good size room, but it's not a big garden. You know, as a living room, you'd say great. As a garden, you'd say a little tight. Anyway, it has a few different things. But for our purposes, the most important part are three raised beds that are my vegetable garden. And then there's a lot of dry land plantings around them and a little fire pit in the middle.
Ooh,
patio.
For like s'mores and late night cocktails and drag
shows.
Well,
we've roasted whole pigs actually on that thing.
No, you haven't.
Oh yeah. Several. Yeah.
Why?
Because they don't taste good raw.
Okay. All right. I will remember that for the future.
Yeah, no, when I was researching Cooked, my book about cooking, there's a chapter on fire and cooking directly over fire. And I went to I went to North Carolina and learned a lot about barbecue techniques and thought it would be really interesting. And we had a series of events where we cooked a whole pig. And it's a great event because you're up all night. You know, it's a very slow process. You cook at extremely low temperature. And you take turns. Somebody comes over for a few hours. I, you know, sometimes a student would do a couple hours, and then I'd come, and my friend Jack would come, and then we'd serve the next night. And I'm not eating meat anymore, but I can get nostalgic for that pork.
So, most of us, okay, myself included, if you think land is tight in Berkeley, San Francisco, I mean, I don't even know anyone that has a yard. So is there any way to garden if you don't have a yard or you just got the tiniest little baby yard? Like I have a window outside my bathroom that I could, I guess, put a box outside of, but is it possible to garden?
Yeah, I think people do windowsill gardening, and there's some crops that are, you know, make sense on a windowsill. Herbs for sure. I mean, growing basil on a windowsill.
Cute.
There's a little local company in Oakland called Back to the Roots that sells a whole lot of indoor gardening supplies, seeds, and also jars that are already planted with herbs and things like that. So I think you can garden just about anywhere, except maybe like solitary confinement in a prison. You know, if you have a windowsill, and preferably, you know, not a north facing window, a south or east or west facing window, you can do it. So my vegetable garden is not tremendous. Each of these raised beds is maybe 20 feet by 3 feet, but they're deep. So you can plant them thickly and the roots can go down. And I'm actually in the process today. I was gardening right before we started of ripping out flowers in some of my beds so I can put in more vegetables. I just think, you know, given the situation we're in, growing your own food is, if you can do it, is imperative. I mean, this is...
Why?
Because it's the safest food you can find. You're the only one who's had any contact with it. You know, no one has to pick it. No one has to transport it. You know, it just you cut it and bring it in the kitchen. So, it, you know, it's is it a privilege? Yeah, it's definitely a privilege. But... it's a lot of people do have some possible gardening, and you can grow a lot of food in a small space if you choose your varieties carefully.
Okay, can I ask you about cooking? Because you've probably written more about food and food systems, or at least more people have read your books about food and food systems than most Americans. So now is a time where a lot of us are being forced to cook, those of us who don't cook, and we're thinking a lot about what we cook. So what should we be eating at home? What's like the best leafy green we should be eating? What's the best comfort food? Like, what are the kinds of things that we should be eating and cooking right now, Michael Pollan?
Well, it's really what you like. I mean, you know, there's no ideal. All leafy greens are really good for you. I think that, you know, when you read doctors talking about how to strengthen your immune system to deal with the fact you may be exposed to this virus, it's really interesting to see that they all talk about eating more plants. All plants have lots of antioxidants. All plants contribute to lowering the inflammation response in the body, and that's what gets people very sick on COVID-19 is their body goes into this inflammatory overdrive. So how do you calm that? Well, one way is eating a plant-based diet. Another way is reducing stress. I mean, I think that, you know, anything we can do, whether it's yoga or meditation or...
Wine.
I'm sorry?
Wine, rosé.
Wine. Yeah, wine. So wine, which is definitely one of my most important coping strategies with what's going on. Full disclosure, some people do feel that, at least in excess, it suppresses your immune system. You know, there's some optimal amount where you get the stress relaxation, but don't get the, the suppression of your immune system. So in general, eating vegetables, I think people are really intimidated by cooking. And I found that I did a book that came out a couple years ago called Cooked. And the idea of this book was to explore cooking as a fundamental human activity that was in decline. And, you know, we are the cooking species, right? There's no other species that cooks. And it defines us. It's the reason, according to the anthropologist, that we have such big brains and relatively small guts. Because
of cooking?
Cooking changes the value of food. You don't have to spend as much time chewing, and you don't have to spend as much time digesting. So if you compare us to a chimpanzee, they spend like 20 hours a day in the act of chewing, you know. You're not gonna.
That's a long time.
You're not gonna create Notre Dame or write Shakespeare if you're spending 20 hours
a day. Not if you're chewing all the time. No.
No. So when we learn to cook, which happens about 2 million years ago, I mean, even before we were Homo sapiens, this basically we were externalizing the digestive process. so that the cooking breaks down the food to a certain extent. So we don't have to break it down as much. And we don't have to chew it as much. And we got all this extra energy because we weren't wasting it in digestion. And where did it go? It went to build these big brains. So we are the cooking species. And there is something that I think still speaks to us about cooking. I mean, you know, people gathering around the fire, the barbecue. So anyway, I was writing a book trying to celebrate cooking and learned a lot about the different techniques, fermentation also, which is a form of cooking. But in general, you know, cooking vegetables is like really, I don't know that there's a bad one for you. I mean,
I have to tell you though, Michael, it feels like I like cooking, but I get sad and lonely when I'm cooking alone. Like before all this, it was like, I didn't like to cook alone because it made me sad. And now I'm trying to figure out a way to enjoy cooking without it actually being a social act. What would you say to people who feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I think making cooking a social act is really important if you can do it. I think it removes the drudgery entirely.
Totally.
Judith and I cook together almost every night. We have a little island in our kitchen so we can both face each other while we're chopping. And,
No, don't tell me. Do you guys face each other while you're chopping? Do you have like matching aprons or something?
No aprons. We don't use aprons.
That's so cute. See, that's what I want. I want a Judith. That's what I want. I need a Judith opposite me to chop with. I ain't got a Judith.
Well, I think that's key. But you're not going to find one during the pandemic.
Oh, I know. It's so hard.
I don't know. I like cooking alone, too. I mean, I do cook alone. I'm kind of that weird person that even if Judith's out of town or something, I'll still make a multi-course meal for myself and I'll still light a candle and have a glass of wine. And to me, missing a meal is just like one of the worst things you can do. Mm-hmm. And by that's meal, I mean, you know, something with intention and pleasure and sitting down and a plate and a fork and a knife.
Let's stay on loneliness for a second. I read, I was reading The New Yorker and Jill Lepore had an article, she did a book review about the former U.S. Surgeon General's book on loneliness in Today. And she said, we hunger for intimacy, we wither without it. And it was all about how primates needed to be in social groups in order to survive. And so we have this like instinct about us that where we like instinctually need community and how there's actually like a physical response when we are lonely and when we're without it. So I wanted to bring that to you and kind of ask you how you, one, if you agree, but also like where you see this like crazy instantaneous shift in human behavior, how you think it's going to affect the way we feel about community, and if you think there are going to be physical manifestations of kind of mass loneliness that might be occurring.
I think there's going to be a lot of trauma. And that's not just from being alone, but it's part of it. But I think we'll be dealing with trauma for years from this event, as we do after a war. I do think that the solitude is and loneliness is. I mean, I haven't read that book yet. I know the author, and I've talked to him about that and the research around loneliness. And yeah, that's real. It's a serious thing. We celebrate independence and autonomy in this culture, especially, you know, the self-made man, you know, independence. Right. But that's all bullshit. I mean, we don't, you know, we don't do well alone. Periods of solitude are wonderful. They're necessary to many kinds of creativity, obviously. But I think the big experiment we're performing right now is, can you, simulate isn't quite the right word, but create a deep sense of connection that isn't physical.
Yeah, so it's so interesting.
How is this different than being live at Manny's?
Oh my God, I hate it. Like all I want to do is like give you a hug right now. You know what I mean? And there's about 1,000 people watching us right now. And if there were 1,000 people watching the two of us have a conversation in real life, we probably would act differently. You know what I mean? You may not be wearing that sweater, though it's a fabulous sweater. You know what I mean? Maybe you would wear something else. Maybe we'd be more nervous. Who knows? Like everything's changed. It does feel weird. Like I'm having a conversation with my.
Well, there's also this energetic exchange with people in the audience. Like I'm not hearing them laugh when I say something hilarious. I listened to Bill Maher the other day, and he had the silliest laugh track. They really tried to calibrate it very carefully, but he kept making fun of it because he was uncomfortable with it. But it just did not work. But and there's touch. You talked about hugging. Human touch, we're designed for that also. And
Like more than other animals?
Well, yes. There are other animals that are just as social as we are, but there are a great many that are much more solitary than we are. But we're definitely on the social end of the scale. And I think that is taking a toll. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, imagine if we were going through this without the internet. Say the internet breaks down in the next few weeks from overuse. As inadequate as this might be, it gives us a lot. We can make eye contact. We body language, you know, can translate through Zoom and things like that. So I'm teaching on Zoom now, and that's been a really interesting experiment for me. It's definitely not optimal, but I can see I've got 12 students in a class, and I can put them all on my screen and see them and know when they're confused and know when they're falling asleep and some people slink away when they leave and they put up they have that still picture of themselves. That person's not in the room.
Let's talk about coffee. I own a coffee shop. I love some coffee, and you just came out with an audio book about caffeine. Can you tell me about the connection between caffeine and capitalism, which I think is so fascinating, interesting, that a lot of us don't think about?
Well, put very simply, think about the coffee break. Coffee break is a fascinating institution. Here you have employers who basically exist to extract value from their employees. That's kind of how the whole capitalist system works, right? People provide more value than they get paid for, and that's called profit. And about 100 years ago, some companies noticed in America that if you gave your staff time off and free coffee, you got more value from them. And they actually did some experiments. And that's why the coffee break was institutionalized. And it's not really institutionalized till the 1950s. That, you know, the idea of free coffee and time off became accepted. It's even in some union contracts now. And it began with a necktie maker in Denver, Wigwam Weavers. And during World War II, they lost all, they had 20 employees operating these looms. And the looms were complicated because tie patterns are very complicated. It took a lot of dexterity and speed to make a beautiful necktie. And they had these young men who operated the looms, but they all got drafted in the war. So then they hired these older guys, retired guys, and the ties looked like shit. They just didn't have the dexterity. Their vision was going, who knows? Then they hired women to do it. And the women made beautiful ties, had the dexterity, but they would get really tired after a few hours and they couldn't do a whole shift without a decrease in the quality of their work. And so the head of the company convened this meeting. They all got together and the employee said, well, if you give us a coffee break, you know, we'll be more productive. So he started providing coffee and gave them 15 minutes at 10 in the morning and 15 minutes at 4 in the afternoon, something like that. And suddenly the women were producing as much in a day as, you know, as the men could do. And they're even people who weren't that good became really good. And he institutionalized it. He required a coffee break. So coffee, you know, is a great productivity drug. It makes us more efficient. It improves our performance physically and mentally. If you drink consume caffeine after you've studied, say you're trying to, you know, you're cramming for a test. If you have caffeine after it, you will perform better. You will remember that material better. So it's a kind of wonderful drug that way. And capitalism seized on it. They also extract a lot of value at the other end of the food chain. The people who grow coffee are small farmers who get paid a fraction of what you pay for coffee. And in Central America, the system that produces coffee was and still is very brutal in many ways. And that the people who grow our coffee are, you know, horribly exploited. And there's efforts to remedy that with fair trade and things right. like that. But the other thing I learned that was kind of alarming is that our supply of coffee is in serious jeopardy.
Why?
Climate change. So coffee is a very picky plant. It grows only in a narrow band in the tropical highlands at a certain altitude. It's got to face the right way. It needs steep hillsides, good drainage.
Okay.
And the current estimates are that about 50% of the land where we're now growing coffee will not be suitable for coffee production in the next 30 years, in just 30 okay. years. So, you know, that's bad news.
What will be some long-term shifts with COVID-19 on how we eat? Do you see more individuals trying to grow their own food and become more self-sufficient?
First of all, I have to answer all of these future questions. Yeah. I don't know. If Judith were here, she would say, he doesn't know anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
However, the food system is going to be pressed, is going to be challenged. We haven't seen it yet. So far, we've seen a demand problem, which is mm-hmm. hoarding. But what happens when we have a supply problem? Mm-hmm. And I worry about that. And we have to look at the mostly migrant farm workers who are planting mm-hmm. right now and picking crops. They are the most essential people and the most vulnerable.
Right.
And that is, I think, a real problem in the system.
They're the ones who are being left out with by all the measures that our governments are putting in to support people. They're not getting $1,200 checks in the mail.
No, they're not getting anything. And they're yeah. not getting covered for their health insurance.
Nothing.
And
indeed, no unemployment.
Are not going to be let in. So the food system we have is very productive, but it's also very brittle. And part of that brittleness has to do with it's this very complex, long supply chain that spans the whole country. I do think that this crisis will show people the virtues of a somewhat more localized food system. Mm-hmm. It will show people the virtues of growing some of your own food mm-hmm. in the same way the Victory Garden movement did during World War I and World War II. I think we will see a renaissance in home gardening. And I think you will see an appreciation. I mean, we're shopping now like people in the Soviet bloc, you know. Mm-hmm. You're walking through the store and you get so excited when you yeah. see a certain item. Dried beans, you know, there's a run on dried beans.
And really?
The other day I managed to score some Rancho Gordo Marcello beans, which, you know, I've been really eager to try. And it was like a triumph. And this is how people shopped in the Soviet Union in the,
oh
in
my
the
70s God.
And 80s. And here we are. So I think it will lead to changes in the food system. And I hope in the direction of more resilience, because it's clearly we don't have a resilient system.
Do you think it's possible that this pause in our traditional productivity might have longer term ramifications for climate change, the environment? A lot of people are hoping that this kind of reset might help us re-energize in the environmental movement and have long-term ramifications. Do you think that that's possible?
I think it's possible. I think it's a little hard to predict. One of the silver linings of this is what we're doing for the climate right now. This year will not be a new record in greenhouse gases or in temperature increase, probably. Mm-hmm. For the first time in how many years? It shows that I think that, you know, we can reduce our carbon footprint dramatically. But, you know, my guess, I mean, I think the big question is, do people acquire new habits living mm-hmm. this way for the next few months? Whether it's hygiene or use of energy or mm-hmm. how they entertain themselves, or are they so bored and so frustrated by the new regime that they can't wait to go back to the old way? Of, you know, whether it's wasting energy, not washing your hands, going to restaurants. And so, you know, yeah, everybody's cooking, and people are learning about cooking, and I'm trading recipes with, you know, members of my family and cooking things I've never cooked before. But will people continue or just like enough of that? After World War II, you know, that we had rationing for World War II and sugar and butter and eggs. And as soon as the rationing was lifted, people binged on all that food. So I think the question is whether have we learned new habits and we find them satisfying, and that we, we're finding the most positive aspects of the way we're living now. The sense of gratitude we have for our health and for the people in, and that of the people in our lives, the sense of gratitude we have for finding a beautiful avocado in the market now.
Or a can of beans.
Whatever it is, whether we hold on to that savor or just can't wait to revert. And, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. There's a tendency, I think, for lots of people who, whether they have environmental ideas or political ideas or public health ideas, to use this emergency to illustrate their fondest hopes. And I'm trying to avoid doing that.
So my last question to you is, are we going to be okay?
I mean, who's we? You know, this pandemic is affecting different people differently. There are people, while we're having this conversation by Zoom, they're, you know, they're Amazon delivery guys and gals. There are people in the warehouses. There are people, there are farm workers picking food, so there'll still be food in the stores, you know, in a couple days. There are people much more vulnerable than those of us who can shelter in place. We're very lucky, too, in the Bay Area that our you know, health commissioners and then governor locked things down really early, and that seems to have helped quite a bit. You know, as a species, as a country, I mean, what does it mean to be okay? I think we'll be scarred by this in various ways. I think it will pass. I think that we will, you know, the amount of scientific brain power being applied to this problem right now, all over the world, we've never had. It's like a Manhattan Project, you know, without any kind of formal entity. But there will be a vaccine and there will be medicines. And hopefully in a year, we won't be talking about this. But for the rest of this year, I think we will be. And I think it will change a lot about us. But I think people are pulling together. It's amazing. You know, this puts enormous power, enormous weight on the social fabric. And I worry about it tearing. But so far, people have been acting in a communitarian way. Here in Berkeley, we all walk in the afternoons. I hope they don't forbid that. And there's this choreography now of people, like if you're on the sidewalk and someone else is coming, you move into the street and you thank the person. So I see a lot of community spirit coming out of this and heroism, of course, on the part of medical workers. You know, we will be changed by it. Most of us will be okay. I'm in a way encouraged by the fact that there's so many asymptomatic cases, apparently like a quarter, which suggests that many more people have had it than realize it. And that means there are many more people who can't get it. And that we are developing immunity in the species, and the question is just how long will that take? And but if we can get to the point where the hospitals are not overwhelmed, and that if you get sick you can go to the hospital, it'll still kill people, but it won't kill people for that reason. It won't kill people because we f***ed up and we weren't prepared and we didn't have the ICUs in the right places and reasons. Now, I'm just afraid, I don't want to see a lot of people die because of political failure.
Right. Well, and what's going to keep me going in my dark moments is just a vision of you and Judith chopping vegetables across from each other. And you're,
we'll be doing it very soon.
Okay, good.
I wish you could come over.
Next, after the pandemic.
Sounds good. You're invited.
I'll be your sous chef. And before we go, I appreciate you, Michael Pollan, for taking time out of your schedule.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk to an audience, and thanks to everybody who showed up.
Absolutely. Thanks for doing this.
Bye-bye, Manny.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this installment of Welcome to Manny's. To check out the full roster of upcoming talks, head to welcometomannies.com. The show was produced by David Boyer, that's me, and engineered by Gabe Graben. The theme music is These Times by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Manny Ukutial and David Perry for making this happen. We'll meet you next Friday at 5 p.m. right here on KALW.